This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Simon Strauss in Lenox, Massachusetts on August 24th, 1994. That got cut off. So if you had a buying arrangement, you were buying concentrates from a small company, what would be an example?
Well, an example would be Hecla Mining.
Okay, now you would have, I suppose, a relationship with these people that would continue for years and years and years. Did you have to renegotiate periodically, and how often, and how was this done?
Well, it varies, and it depends on what the individual mining company wants to do, if they want to have flexibility and be able to deal with other custom smelters and refineries as well as you, they would typically negotiate maybe a contract for 1 or 2 years.
The prices go up and down quite a lot.
Yes, but there's no obligation for the mining company to deliver. They say that they will ship to your smelter, provided they're running the mine, but if they choose to shut the mine down, they have no obligation to deliver the material.
Mm-hmm.
So their decision is as to whether they continue to operate is based on the prices going up and down, and if the price goes down, they may close the mine, in which case the smelter loses a source of its feed. This whole question of the custom smelting and refining is quite a complex one.
It must be very complex.
And there are people who will have a mine that starts off as a producer of concentrate, which they sell. But then, as time goes on, if the mine is profitable, they begin to accumulate cash, they begin to think about building their own facility. A good example would be to cite the San Manuel Copper Mine in Arizona, opened by Newmont for Magma Copper. From the start, they knew they had a big enough proposition to justify a smelter. But originally, they did not want to have a sales organization, so they made an arrangement with Phelps Dodge to sell the blister, which is the intermediate product of the smelter, comparable with bullion, the intermediate product of a copper plant. So Magma sold its blister to Phelps Dodge, which had a large refinery in El Paso. But after a few years, and as the production of the San Manuel mine seemed assured, Newmont, as the owner of the Magma mine at the time, decided to build a refinery, which they did. Immediately adjacent to the smelter, incidentally, in that particular case. And Phelps Dodge lost a source. So the contract between Newmont and Phelps Dodge for the refining of the San Manuel blister was about to expire, and Newmont very properly advised Phelps Dodge that it would build its own refineries. It would not require Phelps Dodge's facilities any longer. And this sort of thing does happen. So as companies look at their prospects, they decide how long the contract should be. Currently, because of the very high cost of opening up major new copper projects, the tendency is to open up a mine with a concentrator, but not to make the additional investment in a smelter and a refinery. This is particularly true of projects located in the developing countries, where the company is concerned about investing too much capital in what may be unstable political situation or currency risks or whatever the future may be. But after a few years of operation, if the deposit is large enough, they may conclude, well, it's time that we had our own smelter and refinery. Mm-hmm. Most of the major new copper projects that have been opened around the world, and there are many of them, have only gone as far as the stage of the concentrator. Now, they have to raise a lot of money. So in order to get that money, they have to persuade the banks that they have an outlet for their concentrates. The result is that these new projects, what people refer to as Greenfield's project, do tend to make long-term contracts. 10 years is a typical term. So they'll make a 10-year contract for smelting and possibly refining. It may contain a particular agreement as to the costs to be charged during the first 2 years, with the understanding that the parties will renegotiate after 2 years. Or it may contain escalator clauses similar to what I described when I was talking about Alcan during the war, to protect against unforeseen contingencies such as sharp changes in labor costs, power costs, transport costs, or whatever. So this question of the relationship between the miner and the processor is a very complex one.
Yeah.
It's constantly shifting. And it is one reason why, in the mining business, the companies that started out primarily as a custom smelters, like American Smelting and Refining Company and American Metal Company, developed much more, if I may say so, market expertise and sophistication than the straight mining companies that had their own facilities, didn't have to take these things into consideration. And a kind of particularly, but Kennecott also are examples of companies that were straightforward miners, even if they had concentrates processed by others, it was on a toll basis. They took care of the marketing, and therefore the terms tended to be more straightforward, and their marketing staffs were less akin to the finer points of, say, trading on the commodity exchanges or protection, other forms of protection. Today, in the light of the upheavals in currency rates that we've had since the energy crisis of 1974, however, everybody's getting more sophisticated. There are a lot more people in the business of trading in metals on commodity exchanges, and they're anxious to develop clientele, and so people are becoming much more sophisticated than was the case when I joined ASARCO in 1946. Much more knowledge of risks, price risks, currency risks, political risks, which are certainly with us to an enormous extent these days.
Those factors are much more important now, aren't they?
They are.
And of course the
they're perceived, because in 1946, when I joined, after all, most of Africa, much of Asia, was still colonial.
Mm-hmm.
The countries of South America had not yet exerted their political independence. Mm-hmm. They were dependent on foreign investors for capital, and they had not undertaken their own marketing or operation.
And the environmental costs were...
The environmental question had not surfaced the way it did in the late 60s and early 70s.
Perhaps we should, before we get into that, you just briefly touched on the Korean War, but
yes.
That, I guess, well, I'm assuming, was that the first sort of crisis that hit after you joined ASNR?
Well, no, there were a lot of interesting developments. One was the change in the status of the British pound, the relationship of the value of the pound to the dollar. For many years, it was almost taken for granted $4.86. Represented the value of a pound sterling, and this was considered sort of immutable.
Mm-hmm.
It went through the period when the prices of gold rose from 2067 an ounce to $35 an ounce, and it was still in place when the Bretton Woods conference was held, but it was clear in the post-war period that the effects of the war on the British economy, the debt that Britain had undertaken as a result of fighting that war, it's the changed position in regard to its empire. All of these things were undermining the value of the British pound. And London, which had been the traditional capital of the world's financial structure, was gradually giving way to New York. So the pound dropped from 486 to, I think the drastic cut came in 48 or 49, to $2.80 a pound. And that really was a major process of readjustment. It was just about that time also that the Marshall Plan was launched. And this began slowly at first, but eventually to change the complexion of the things.
I was thinking the Marshall Plan was earlier than that, but no. I guess you're right. It was
48, 47 at the earliest.
A few years before we got organized for that.
Yes, it took time to get organized, but it began to really influence the markets and revive the economies of Western Europe and somewhat later the economy of Japan. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things that happened was the change in the perception of the position of the United States. During the war, although we were in the war, we didn't suffer war damage to our industrial plant at all.
No.
There had been concern about sabotage, there had been concern about submarine attacks on both coasts, and there were a few efforts, but nothing that had any real consequence. So when we emerged from the war, this country had 2/3 of the world's monetary gold in its supply. It had 50% of the industrial production of the Western world, that is, outside the communist countries. So it consumed 50% of the raw materials. When the Paley Commission report came out in 1951,
This was a report on strategic materials.
The official name was the President's Materials Policy Commission, and it was selected by President Truman, and it was headed by William Paley of the Columbia Broadcasting System. So it became known shorthand as the Paley Commission, and their report in 1951 analyzed the prospects with respect to natural resources, not just minerals, but basic products such as lumber, cotton, for the world over the ensuing quarter century from 1950 to 1970. And in the first volume of a 5-volume report, there was this math showing that with 6% of the area, and I think 9% of the population. I may have gotten those fees reversed. The United States consumed 50% of all the raw materials consumed. And the Paley Commission then estimated what would be consumed in 1975. And although the percentages for the United States were shown as somewhat diminished, there was not a radical change. In fact, however, there was a radical change did occur.
Paley prediction was not a
was not correct.
Accurate.
Mm-hmm. No, the actual consumption by the United States by 1975 was about 25% of the world total, mm-hmm. instead of 50.
And yet they're still quoting those Paley Commission figures.
Yes, some people do. The other thing was that the Paley Commission, after making its estimates of what the requirements for vital resources would be in 1975, expressed grave concern over whether those requirements could be met.
Mm-hmm.
They used the expression that shortages in the past had been met by price adjustments and proved temporary, but they felt that shortages in the future would be much longer lasting. And they were quite wrong about that, because their estimate as to what might be produced was even more wrong than their estimates of what was going to be consumed.
Mm-hmm.
They underestimated the potential to produce by a substantial amount. So this was already beginning to emerge in the immediate post-war period. One of the things that I think was most striking was that very few significant mineral discoveries had been made during the 30s. And I think this conditioned the Paley Commission into thinking that most of the world's mineral resources had already been identified. They failed to recognize that you can't find things unless you look for them, and that exploration had been cut back very sharply, first by the financial stringency of the Depression, and second, by the manpower demands of the war, so that people were not looking. So you had the period really from 1930 to 1945 when exploration was at a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
But as price ceilings came off after the war, and as prices started to respond, and as companies began to show some confidence in the future demand for materials, and particularly as demand revived in the war-damaged areas of Western Europe and Japan, much more exploration was undertaken, and we began to have enormous finds.
Well, there are also these new technological developments, like
exactly.
geophysical.
Exactly, geological. Just as I said, the marketing had become has become more sophisticated. In the same way, the theories of geology have become much more sophisticated, and people are no longer just looking for outcrops. They study soil contents and stream sediments, and they begin to understand that there may be significant resources which don't come to the surface.
And some of these, I guess, were spin-offs of war technology.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Aerial maps.
Right. True. Mm-hmm. And I always think about the area south of Tucson, which the Geological Survey had dismissed as a potential. And now you have major mines, Eureka, mm-hmm. Mission, and so on, which have been developed in that area, which did not come to the surface, did not outcrop, and yet you had very significant copper resources.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long way of of saying that the Paley Commission had estimated that the United States production of copper from its own mines, at best, by 1975, would be 800,000 tons of copper a year. Instead of that, it is currently running more than twice that amount, mm-hmm. as a result of new discoveries in a country where people thought every copper deposit that could be found had been found.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't true.
No.
It wasn't true. So these were developments that were beginning to emerge even before Korea broke out.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Korean War started, there was a lot of concern that it might in fact develop into another mm-hmm. world war, that Russia and China might come to the assistance of North Korea, and that we would eventually be fighting a world conflict again. So the government did slap on price controls. I think it was the war started in middle of 1950, and the price controls came into effect in January of 1951, I believe I'm correct about that. By that time, prices had already moved up substantially. Copper was 24 cents a pound. I think lead and zinc were in the mid-teens. And these prices were put into effect. But to enforce them proved much more difficult than had been the case during World War II, because the Germans were busy buying lead and zinc and copper, the French were buying, the Italians were buying, and there was no way that we could say to the Chileans, you got to sell your copper to us at 24 and a half cents when they could get much better prices in Europe. In the case of copper, actually a compromise was found, and the ridiculous position was developed that consumers were allowed to pay 27 and a half cents for foreign copper, but could only pay 24 and a half cents for domestic copper.
This was a government regulation?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
in Korea. And scrap became almost...
You mean during the Korean period?
During the Korean period.
Not in the country of Korea.
No.
Yeah.
And, so. And scrap became almost uncontrollable. There was talk of putting on export controls on scrap, but in fact they were not. And of course it went where the price was going to be the highest.
Mm-hmm.
So the Korean War was quite different.
Well, now what was ASNR's position on this? Where did you...
We had to live with the regulations with regard to our domestic production.
Mm-hmm.
At that time we were not significant miners of domestic copper. We sold a lot of domestic copper that we had smelted or refined for other people, although our biggest source of copper at that time was Kennecott, because we ran the smelters, Kennecott ran the mine, but we returned the copper to Kennecott and they sold their own copper. So we were not huge copper sellers, but we were suppliers of copper.
Well, were you faced with the decision whether to sell abroad or to the United States?
No, we sold our domestic copper in the United States.
Mm.
Because we wanted to maintain the goodwill of our domestic customers, among other things, and because we were paying the domestic price to the miners that did ship to our smelters
mm-hmm.
and refineries. So we were careful to sell at least that quantity of copper in the United States that we had purchased at the basis of the United States price. What was I going to say to you? The situation became very critical in zinc. In fact, zinc was considered to be one of the most difficult of all the raw materials during World during the Korean War.
Really?
The Prime Minister of England at the time was Attlee. He came over and visited Mr. Truman to see whether Mr. Truman would agree to let the British have some zinc out of the stockpile, which had been created by them, by a congressional law in 1946. But the law was very strict with regard to releases from the stockpile, and so nothing was done to meet the Attlee request. I think sulfur, elemental sulfur, was also on Mr. Attlee's list. There were four commodities. Those are the only two that I recall at the moment that he was particularly concerned about. Jim Boyd, whom you've interviewed earlier, was then director of the Bureau of Mines, and I recall his asking me to come down to Washington to talk with him about what ASARCO could do to increase zinc, copper, and zinc supplies. And I said, well, of course, we have some resources. Mr. Strauss and Mr. Brownell had advised me to reply on this regard. But they're marginal, and we don't know how long this situation is going to last. Well, he said, you ought to do what you can to get them going. And the outcome of that was that we did make a contract with the government to open the Silver Bell mine in Arizona. This had been discussed during World War II, but it was discussed too late and it never materialized. ASARCO agreed to equip and develop the Silver Bell mine to produce a minimum of 12,000 tons of copper a year in exchange for the government undertaking to buy 2 years' production from us at the ceiling price of 24 cents. We went ahead with, invested our own money, developed the mine. As I recall it, by the time we got it going, the Korean crisis was pretty well over. The other significant developments that occurred then were that the government arranged to loan money to Copper Range Company for the opening of the White Pine Mine in Michigan, and to loan money to Newmont for the opening of the San Manuel Mine in Arizona. Kennecott agreed to expand the production from its Ruth Mine in Nevada, part of the Nevada Con operation, in exchange for a contract similar to the one that we had with
The Nevada, what did you say?
Nevada Con, C-O-N, for Consolidated.
Oh, okay. All right.
And Phelps Dodge opened the Sacramento pit at Bisbee, also under a similar type of arrangement. So the government made two loans and four purchase contracts to expand copper production. There were some deals made to expand zinc mine production. I think the ceiling price for zinc was 17.5 cents a pound. And the steel companies were so concerned about zinc at that time that the steel company, U.S. Steel, made a contract with American Zinc, Lead, and Smelting, agreeing to a fixed price of 17.5 cents a pound for 4 years.
That's a long time.
Before the 4 years had expired, the Korean crisis was over, the price of zinc had dropped. Howard Young, who was then the head of American Zinc, in a conversation with me, told me that American Zinc, U.S. Steel said, we'll live up to the contract. We signed it, and we'll pay you 17.5 cents, even though we can buy zinc much more cheaply. But we'll have to let you know that at the end of that contract, you're no longer our supplier. So they were really sort of blackballed into agreeing to take a lesser price, even though they had a firm contract. And that experience taught me something. Don't make firm price contract, long-term firm price contracts with customers, because they won't live up to them, or if they do live up to them, they will threaten you with never continuing their relationships with them. Sell at the market price.
It's just too volatile to...
Yeah. Nobody can read the future with that certainty.
No.
And there are examples, of course, where firm prices have been offered and have been lived up to, the outstanding example being the uranium program of the AEC that you and I talked about, where they offered a price of, I think it was $10 a pound for uranium concentrate.
That was, again, an artificial
situation, and it was a government which had a program and could have put this uranium in stockpile, and they weren't in the competitive market as U.S. Steel was. U.S. Steel's point with Mr. Young was valid, and that is that they had to sell galvanized steel in competition with other people who were paying lower prices for zinc. So if Howard Young insisted on their paying 17.5 cents, they would be stuck. And there you are. Firm price contracts are not what they're touted to be. Well, this is a sort of a disorganized discussion of the events in the Korean War. Early on...
Let me just change this.
Early on, a gentleman by the name of John Weinberg, who was a senior partner of Goldman Sachs and Company, and who had been called down to Washington to help the government recruit industry people for the Korean effort, asked me to come down and see him, which I did, and he said he was aware of what I had done at Metals Reserve during the Second World War, and would I come back to Washington to undertake similar activities during the Korean War. I explained to Mr. Weinberg the position of my wife and that I really couldn't move her to Washington and that I couldn't undertake to live away from her. She needed me to be with her most of the time. But I did agree to be a consultant and come down to Washington one day a week, which I did throughout the Korean War period. I was a consultant to something, I think the name was the Defense Materials Policy Commission, and it was headed by an Oklahoma lawyer by the name of Jess Larson, a very able gentleman. I would come down every Thursday, I think it was.
Must have been hard by train?
No. By that time, there was good air. I would fly down in the mornings and fly home in the evening. And there was an amusing incident as a result of this commuting of my mine. It must have been about 1953. I had been in Washington with the DMPC during the day. And I was scheduled to return to in New York on a 5:45 flight out of the National Airport. I got out to the airport in time, and I was standing waiting there when along came a diminutive Chinaman named K.C. Lee. Mr. Lee, that's spelled L-I, not L-W-E. Mr. Lee was then probably the foremost expert on tungsten in the world. And we had gotten to know each other very well during World War II. We saw a lot of each other because he was very helpful in advising the government on meeting the procurement problems on tungsten and a number of the other alloying elements. "Oh, Simon," he said when he saw me, he said, "what fright are you on?" And I said, "I'm on the 545. "Oh," he said, "I have a ticket on the 515. He said, "let me see whether I can get on your plane." So he went over to the American Airlines counter, American then operated. And he came back and he said, "no seats on your flight." He said, so I said, "well, I'm sorry." I said, "we probably could get on a later one, but my wife has made a dinner engagement for us in New York and I'm anxious to get back." He understood. We stood there chatting. There was an announcement over the loudspeaker that for some reason the 545 flight was indefinitely delayed. So Mr. Lee whipped out his ticket for the 515 flight and he said, "here, you go on my plane." He said, I'm in no hurry, I can take later." So I said, "thank you very much, KC." I got on the 515, which left almost immediately. In those days, the stewardess came around and asked you your name and destination, because most of the planes either went on to Albany or to Boston. So when she came to me, I had his ticket. I said, "Lee," and LaGuardia. And of course, it caused no comment. The next morning, Mr. Lee called me up laughing. He said, "Simon, you know what happened?" He says, "I got on your plane," he said, "and when the stewardess came around and asked me my name, I said, 'Sklaus.' She looked at me, she said, 'you don't look like Sklaus.'" In those days, they used to have the name of the pilot and the flight attendants on the door leading to the cockpit. Mm-hmm. And he had seen that her name was Mulligan. He said, "well, you don't look like Mulligan to me." And from that day on, I used to run into him frequently. His office was in the Woolworth building, not far from where the ASARCO offices were, and we occasionally had lunch together. And whenever we met, he would say to me, "you know me, my name's Sklaus."
Oh, funny.
So, I was very much obliged to him for having let me have his ticket.
You certainly don't look like Mr. Lee.
Not L-I, but no. L-E-E is a possibility.
You could pass for that, but not L-I.
Yeah. No, she didn't look at the ticket, she just heard the word.
Right. Uh-huh. So how long did this Defense Minerals...
I continued to be their advisor for about 3 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And then it was replaced by an office of something or other based in the White House, headed by a very nice gentleman named Arthur Fleming. And he asked me to continue, but it didn't involve going down once a week. Mm-hmm. I just from time to time when they had problems. Mm-hmm. With regard to the stockpile, I'm going to ask me.
Right. We're continuing now after a break for lunch. This is still August 24th. And we had just finished your work with the Defense Minerals Procurement Commission. And so we'll get back to what you were doing, I guess, with ASNR.
Right. After I took over from Kenneth Brownell as the vice president in charge of sales, my principal duties were not so much to do any selling myself as to ascertain what amounts of minerals we needed to sell and where to sell them.
You were getting up into policy, in other words.
That is correct.
More than
each of the principal materials, we had a salesman and an assistant assigned to cover them. We had a copper salesman with an assistant, a lead sales manager with an assistant, a zinc sales manager with an assistant, a silver and gold salesman, and we had a byproduct salesman who would have been responsible for disposing of bismuth, cadmium, antimony, selenium, tellurium, indium, and any other byproducts that were produced by the company's refineries.
Was there any question of expanding, say, to aluminum? Or
we were not in the aluminum.
You never,
business.
Ever got into aluminum?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about getting into aluminum. And at one point, when the defense materials plant facilities were put up for sale by the government, I had referred to the fact earlier that they'd been built by Alcoa and that they had actually been operated during the war by Reynolds and Kaiser. After the war, the government wanted to dispose of these, put these products up for sale. I said products, I mean plants, mm-hmm. These properties up for sale. And ASARCO did bid on some of the aluminum facilities in the Northwest in the hope of getting into the business. But the Kaiser organization outbid us, and so we did not get them. And subsequently, we made no real effort to get into aluminum production. A number of our competitors in the copper, lead, and zinc business did consider doing this. Amex, the former American Metal Company, eventually became a significant producer of aluminum. The Anaconda organization went into aluminum production, but without any conspicuous success. Within ASARCO, our feeling was that the amount of capital investment required to become a successful competitor in aluminum was very large, and we had many other uses for the capital available to us. So we never did really go into aluminum.
Nickel was another thing that you did.
Yes. we made at least two efforts to get into the nickel business, in which I played a part. One was the Thayer Lindsay organization that I referred to earlier seemed to be receptive to disposing of its holdings in Falconbridge Nickel, the second largest Canadian producer, and ASARCO took a very serious look at this. we made a bid. It wasn't high enough to interest the NC organization. There were no other bidders, and they finally decided to remain in the business.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, it was too bad that we hadn't been a little more aggressive in going after it, because Falcon Bridge had a very sound business, and in the long run, it would have been a profitable investment.
Were you involved in any of these decisions?
Yes, because I was constantly being consulted by management as to the outlook for metals. One of my jobs was to make projections as to what the future prices of metals were likely to be, what the level of consumption of metals was likely to be. And I was very favorably disposed toward going in the nickel business. But here again, it would have required quite a bit of business, capital. During the Korean War, the government made a real effort to dispose of the Nicaro nickel project in Cuba, which I mentioned earlier, and which I visited. The Nicaro project had been closed down at the end of the Second World War. But with Korea underway, it was decided that perhaps it should be reactivated. Bear in mind that this was in the period before Castro took over in Cuba. Batista was then the ruler in Cuba. Freeport approached us whether we would be willing to be a partner to bid for the Nicaro project. We had a lengthy consultation on it. We did a lot of work. One of Sargos' associate general counsels, a chap named Lyman Tundell, T-O-N-D-E-L, who later became a leading figure in the New York Bar Association, and I were assigned the job of dealing with Freeport, dealing with the government, deciding what our bids should be. And we submitted a bid. But we were outbid this time by the National Lead Company, which went in association with the Dutch firm of Billiton and Company. And they succeeded in getting the contract to operate the Nicaro project from the government, and with some kind of an arrangement under which they would eventually take it over. However, a few years down the pike, Mr. Castro came along, the Nicaro project was seized as rightfully belonging to the Cuban people, and it has been operated since then by the Cuban communist regime. So those were our two real efforts to get into nickel. We did have some joint exploration ventures with Freeport in Indonesia, but they didn't turn out too well, and so.
You didn't ever get into sulfur?
Well, bear in mind that all of our smelters were recovering quantities of sulfur in the form of sulfuric acid, so mm-hmm. in a sense we were really in that business. We did not explore for sulfur. Mm-hmm. Primary sulfur resources. I remember now there was also some a venture for exploring for nickel in the extreme north of Quebec, in the area called Ungava. That's U-N-G-A-V-A. A sizable deposit was located, but the economics did not look attractive. We did not go forward with that. I believe that now, some 30 years later, Falcon Bridge is making an effort to bring that property into production.
What about molybdenum?
We became producers of molybdenum as a byproduct at our copper properties. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, we had a major exploration program on a molybdenum property in Idaho, but that was in an area close to wilderness. The governor of Idaho, who later became Secretary of the Interior, I'll think of his name later, was not favorably disposed toward us or operating the thing, and we did not go through with that. One other commodity that we did diversify into and made a large investment, and for many years it was a successful undertaking, was asbestos. There was a deposit of asbestos under a lake in Quebec called Black Lake. The area around the lake belonged to the Asbestos Corporation of America, but they had not taken any steps to claim the land under the lake. A Canadian geologist by the name of Malouf, M-A-L-O-U-F, did some drilling through the ice in the winter, determined that there was a sizable deposit of asbestos on it, lacked the capital to bring it into operation, came to us as to whether we had any interest. The people in the mining department asked me to do a survey of the outlook for asbestos, which I did. This was in the early 1950s. Asbestos was then a strongly growing industry. In particular, the demand for asbestos cement products were growing. Asbestos cement pipe was being used as a competitor of steel for water systems under the, in major municipalities. Asbestos cement roofs and other construction of asbestos cement was going forward, not so much in the United States as in tropical countries that lacked timber access, needed cheap materials, had plenty of cement on hand, but needed the strength of asbestos to go ahead with it. And it seemed to me that this was a growth industry. The traditional uses of asbestos for flame proofing, for insulation, for brake linings in automobiles all seemed like growth industries to me. So I urged the mining department to go forward with this. And
there wasn't any talk of asbestosis.
Not at that time. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say there wasn't any talk. There was one professor who was already beginning to express concern, but he did not have wide support. And the company made a deal with Mr. Malouf. We took over the property from him. We didn't pay outright cash. I think he was given some kind of a carried interest in it. It was necessary to convince the authorities in Quebec that what needed to be done was divert the waters of the streams flowing into Lake Asbestos, into Black Lake, and to relocate the state highways, to dredge the lake, redirect the flow of the waters, and get at the underlying
deposit. You were actually going to mine through the lake.
Well, we were going to eliminate the lake.
Move the lake.
Move the water. There would no longer be a lake. The lake would be the foundation for an open pit. Our mining people were very ingenious on this. We put a dredge on because there was this oozy slime on the bottom of the lake accumulated over the centuries that could be better handled with dredging equipment than it could with shovels or other excavators.
How large a lake was it?
It was sizable. Several hundred acres, possibly comparable with Lake Mackinac that we're looking at the moment. In total, the investment was some $30 or $40 million. We got the property into production in the mid or later 50s, maybe 56 or 57.
No controversy from any environmentalists over moving
the lake? Not at that time. No, there was some opposition from the Asbestos Corporation of America, of Canada, I guess, who had overlooked the fact that there might be a deposit there. But in general, the authorities in Quebec were very supportive because there was a high unemployment and this promised to create several hundred jobs.
Nobody in your company objected to that?
No. We built a very modern mill, employed people with a lot of experience in asbestos processing, and eventually we got into production. As I said earlier, I did not anticipate that we would do much sailing in the United States, but our sales agents outside the United States, who were already handling metals for us, some of them boned up on sale of asbestos and were eager to handle it for us. Others who felt that they didn't know enough about the material were less sanguine, and then we found other people to be our agents. I enlisted agents in Belgium, which was an important consuming area, Holland, France, Germany, and Italy. We had a sales manager, a French-Canadian, who had previously worked for other companies in the asbestos industry, to be the sales manager in Canada, and he took care of any sales in either Canada or the United States. And the business was profitable from the start. It went very well. The market did continue to expand for a number of years until the concern about asbestosis became so rampant. I believe that this Asarco has now completely disposed of its interest in lake asbestos, but it was a successful investment. And unlike a lot of people, I believe that the concern about the medical effects of asbestos have been greatly overstressed. Certainly the workers in Quebec who mined and processed this material did not have the excessive experience with the lung cancer that is supposed to have been. Apparently the greatest number of injuries were people in the brake linings business who had to cut, grind, and reshape the textiles containing the asbestos. Apparently that brought out a lot of dust. And the people working in insulation of asbestos, for instance, it had been the practice when buildings were being erected to insulate the steel girders with asbestos. The pluses of asbestos have been very much overlooked, but thousands of lives have been saved because of the effective use of brake linings to stop vehicles before hitting pedestrians or other vehicles. Thousands of lives have been saved in fires because of the retarding effects of asbestos on the spread of flames. And it's unfortunate that the material has gotten such a wrong, a bad name. Above all, I think one of the most ridiculous and unnecessary expenditure of public funds has been the expenditure of billions of dollars to remove asbestos from school buildings in this country. Those dollars could much better have been spent to improve the level of education, to increase teachers' salaries. I have yet to hear of a single case of asbestosis that was contracted by a school child, not one. And while I understand people's concerns with the environment, and I certainly agree that we should assure ourselves of a safe world, I think that asbestos is an example of environmental overkill.
You were never, no suit like the one at Johns Manville was ever brought against us.
Well, most of the suits against Johns Manville, Eagle Pitcher, and other companies arose out of a disease that was traced to exposure to asbestos during World War II. ASARCO was not in business then, was not selling asbestos.
It was in the ships.
In the ship insulation, particularly on naval ships where asbestos was used for insulating the electrical cable installations in the ship. That accounted for a large part of it. I think Lake Asbestos was named in some suits, and I'm not aware because when I retired, up to that time there had been no major findings against ASARCO, but in view of the fact that the bulk of the asbestos was sold outside the United States. And it's in the United States that this explosion of asbestos litigation has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact that we got into the business when we did. ASARCO did not have the kind of exposure that Johns Manville, who had been in the business from the start, were really the initiators of it. And Eagle Pitcher, who had been very active in the business during the war years. I think that helps to explain why it has suffered less on this litigation. Your questioning about these various other commodities and ASARCO's interest in it reminds me, one of my major responsibilities in ASARCO was to do biennial studies, that is once every 2 years, of the metal markets and try to get together as much information as possible with regard to the outlook for production and for consumption and what the balance would be between the two and what the likely effect was on prices. The principal purpose of this was to provide guidance to the exploration people in the mining department as to which metals they should particularly emphasize in their selling, in their exploration, and to help them in their feasibility studies. Because when you are studying a potential new mine, and you're trying to calculate whether or not it would be worthwhile to develop it, you have to make some assumptions as to the price you will get for the product from that mine. One of the real difficulties is that when the mine has been, when the deposit has first been identified, one can assume that it will take anywhere from 5 to 10 years to complete the exploration, to equip it for production, to prepare the mine, to build the processing plants. And the result is that you're not really trying to forecast the price for the next month or the next year or even the next 2 or 3 years. You're looking down the road and trying to see what prices are likely to be 5, 10, 15, or 20 years hence.
Mm, must be so hard.
Which is a difficult thing to do. But just to make this concrete and to show, the Mount Isa mine, one of the greatest and most profitable metal deposits ever located, was found in 1923. It actually began production in 1933, 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Tocopala, one of the major mines of Southern Peru Copper Company, was first identified perhaps when the Spaniards arrived in Peru. The modern phase of exploration began in the early 30s when the Cerro de Pasco Copper Company took an option on the Tocopala deposit, did some exploration work, identified the nature of the deposit,